Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hi everybody, it's Bill Barton from Barton Legal and welcome to another Barton Legal podcast. Today I'm very excited to be joined by Lyndon White, who's joining us all the way from Australia. You're south of Sydney, aren't you?
Yeah, south of Sydney, currently in Brisbane for this call.
Ryan.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Brisbane is my, sorry to any Australians listening, but Brisbane is my favourite Australian city.
And so
there's just something absolutely lovely about, much as I love Canberra, you know, and there's my family think I'm barking mad why anybody likes Canberra, but there are family reasons I like,
yes,
Canberra. Anyway, so today we have a very interesting day because I'm actually doing four podcasts. Chats today, and so we've got Lyndon. So it's currently just gone 11 o'clock here in Leeds. What time is it with you?
10 past 8 in the evening.
So 10 past 8 in the evening.
Not and then bedtime.
In a couple of hours, we've got Larry all the way from California, and he's right, like 10 hours the other way. So we really are spanning the globe today, spanning the globe. And there's a good place always to start. As I normally do, Whitey, can you introduce yourself in sort of a minute?
I think the best introduction, Bill, is it's contextual. And that is, I'm a mate of Bill's. And the reason I'm a mate of Bill's is because Bill's got this outlook on life that is different to just about any other lawyer that you'll meet in the world, which is that he actually wants to communicate with people. A lot of lawyers communicate with people, but specifically for their own reasons, which is, you know, business or, I don't know, something in relation to their own professional development. Whereas with Bill, it's a social development. So the first thing is, I'm a mate of Bill's. Now, he mightn't accept that. And if he doesn't, there will be retribution. The other part that's important is, I suppose, the reason that I'm friendly with Bill is because when we started a dialogue with each other, it wasn't that we had the same interest, singular, in talking to other people. So I suppose my fundamental thing that I do is communicate not so well at a lot of times and not so articulate so that people can actually understand what I'm talking about. But I've had a history of starting out as a civil engineer and then shifting into studying law and then being admitted later on in life, and found that in 2005, I think it was, I went to a session where someone said, and who are you and what do you do? And I said, well, I punch up clients so that we can get lots of money out of it. Half an hour later, the same person came back to the room and said, so what have we learned in the last half an hour? And he came to me and he said, what about you? I said, I'm doing it wrong. So in that sense, that's who I am, as a friend of Bill's that interacts in similar environments to Bill.
And what a great introduction. Thank you very much. You're very kind. So within a few minutes of introducing you, you're already threatening me. I'm not sure if that's, you know, an Australian thing, but yeah. So we met a few years ago, I think through webinar. Lyndon Whitey was very kind to immediately get in touch and offer to introduce some people he knew to me. And as he says, our friendship has grown from there because he's introduced people to us that we have contacted in relation to work and also to speaking on the webinar. We've met up when he's been in London. And I think we have the same approach because it's not just about meeting and talking to people, but we have a similar, well, you certainly do now. I'm pretty sure that mine has developed probably in the same way as yours, of having a more collaborative approach. And I find it vaguely amusing in a way that the general industry law, and particularly in construction, has become, outwardly it says it's more collaborative over the last 5 or 6 years. I'm not sure in practice that it definitely is, but those are things that you and I have been doing for a long, long time and telling people, and yet still people want to have a punch-up. You know, you had your own business, you know, dial before you dispute, and that's you know, sums up. People are very quick to have a dispute, and I think we're both interested in a collaborative approach. So I know you've done lots of different things, and we're going to flit around all over the place about work. And you sent me a question yesterday about the difference between Joni Mitchell and Ozzy Osbourne. Well, at least one of them's dead. I haven't had the chance to check if Joni Mitchell's dead. I mean, she must be very old by now, but have to, I don't know. But I was going to start with, because you're very interested in collaborative working, and I know, and I want to talk to you about the different countries you've been to and engineer. How did you come to work with FIDIC? Because you've been on their collaborative contracting body, haven't you?
Yeah, still in Task Group 17 for the Contracts Committee, where we're drafting up a collaborative form of contract. A few years ago, FIDIC said, along the lines of, maybe we need something in our suite that attends to this part of the market where other forms of contract are into. We had a discussion with the task group leader on that one, Kiri Park, another good person for your podcast, and the chairperson that is in there, as well as Andrea Chow from the Netherlands, teaches me lots of great vernacular, and absolute professionals in the world of, you know, collaborative contracting. And I suppose once we started to talk about things, it was a very short conversation, in the sense that we went into very similar ground, which is, we didn't have to convince each other about what it is that, firstly, our initial views were, and also how you might proliferate something that people these days call collaborative contracting. Used to be called relationship, used to be called all sorts of things, I would imagine, in any language. But I suppose it comes down to two things with a collaborative mindset, which is, you've got to be willing and you've got to be able. You know, we're seeing something in most of the media around the place now about the coalition of the willing, for example, and I'm not talking politics here, but just as a general phrase. And that's a really lovely way to put things out. There's a coalition of the willing, but what about the coalition of the willing and the able to do something? And I think that's the two criteria for collaboration. And forget everything else about money, and forget everything else about scope of work. It's all about, if you and I, and James in this sense, is part of this collaborative arrangement that we've got here, all of us bring something different to the table, some more than others. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be, I'm taking on, you know, your risk, for example, or vice versa, or some liability. I'm sure if I said something that was out of turn that may be offensive to people, that would be your liability in a reputational sense. So I suppose, to answer your question directly on that, is how did I get involved in collaboration? I think I actually just fell into it, because I tried so hard in the first stages of my career to be a pompous peanut at times, where you had to have the upper hand against someone, or you had to demonstrate that you were the one that was in control for some reason, or exercise an entitlement. And having started my career on the client side, and then moving to the contractor side later, and then the consultant and a few other bits in between, I found that there's a really common thread amongst people, which is, people want to succeed at things. So even people who are probably not succeeding in the same way that we might see success, and that's the Joni Mitchell side of it, you know, everyone's happy, everyone's cuddling, playing lovely, lovely music. You take the Ozzy Osbourne approach. He's successful in scaring people, or he was, and until his untimely death. And I think that's what's really important, is that people generally want to succeed. So in context there, in a construction world, if people want to succeed, what do they need to succeed? Do they need to actually beat someone? Is it actually an environment where there is runs on the board, or is it more something else where it's a project arrangement where everyone's trying to achieve the same end? And that's one of those corny lines that you hear around the place, and people say, oh, wouldn't that be lovely, and can't we do it? Then the next question is, how do you get there? And that's where the willingness and ability comes back into it. So what I've found, Bill, is for years I had a lot of willingness, but I didn't have the ability. And I'm sure that there's still a measure on there where there's always building your abilities.
No, I think that's right. One of my first sort of bosses, Francis Kirkham, always told me you never stop learning. It doesn't matter where you are in your career, and I think that's very true. I think what you say about collaboration is also very accurate. You have to be willing and able, but you also have to have, I think, a determination to make it work. But it's also making people understand. I think they conflate collaboration with an equal sharing, you know, an equal division of risk, if you're talking about a building contract, and that isn't what actual collaboration is. Collaboration is, in my view, it's simply working in a or reducing the adversarial element. So yes, if you have a dispute, that can be adversarial, but you can still have at the beginning of a dispute alternative dispute methods where you have meetings between directors and boards and different things, layers, isn't it? Until you get to the point. But you should thin things out. Collaboratively, yeah, people talk about it, but I find that insufficient people, organisations invest enough money to make that collaboration actually possible because they talk about, you know, I always say about, you know, it's scouts and you sit around a fire singing Kumbaya and holding hands and hugging. But as soon as the contract starts, everybody looks for an advantage. That's not collaborative working. Collaborative working is when if you're the engineer, you say to the contractor, look, you do know you need to give a notice by Friday. Please give me a notice, you know, and okay, rather than waiting until they've missed it, or as a contractor, giving that early warning. But it's a very interesting thing that there's a lot of talk about collaboration all through these podcasts, and it shows that it crosses continents, it crosses background, but interestingly, as sort of lawyers we've all come from quite an adversarial approach, and I don't know if that is because things used to be heavily male dominated. I mean, I do think as more women have been in the ascendancy in law and in construction in particular, more sensible approaches, I think there's a bit less testosterone perhaps, I don't know. So you've worked with different people and you kindly shared some nice, lovely swear words before we started. So from the Dutch.
Provoked, but, I was.
Yeah, you were provoked. What do you enjoy about when you're, and presumably your meetings are all virtual, it must be difficult to get together, or have you managed to get together in person?
Oh, yeah. It's been great. We actually had and this is just specific to the FITIC group, we had a gas bag in Geneva in 2022 at one of the conferences there. That was excellent. And then another one in Barcelona last year at the Fusion for Energy conference that they had there. We went and spent some time and chatted through things, worked on other concepts that were different to where we were pursuing, and it gave us a whole different perspective. And the wonderful Professor David Mosey was there, and another great person, right, if you ever want to put it on your podcast. But David, I think it's a CVE that he has for his collaborative contracting work in the UK. So he developed, invented, if you like, FAC1. You've come across it, and
but it's fascinating, isn't it? When you meet these different people and you find out about their background, and I love the fact that, you know, you've met them in Geneva and Barcelona, so you're all away from your home countries as well.
Yeah.
So, and your career has been one about travel. When you started, because you did your first degree, didn't you? Southern Cross.
Oh, no, civil engineering. It was back in the 80s. Yeah.
So, yeah, that
was
that was
the 1980s, engineering, not the 1880s. Yeah.
So how did you imagine back then as a student? How did you sort of see as an engineer? Did you think you'd just stay in Australia? Did you think you'd travel? Did you think you'd, you know, sort of climb out of the engineering or move somewhere else? You know, can you remember what your outlook was as a 20-year-old?
100%. Yeah. Well, I was a 17-year-old at the time when I started all that. And the boss that I had there was ex-British Army, had worked in 76 countries. He used to eat nails for breakfast. He wasn't a harsh man, but he was a hard man. He'd been a lot of places. And the very first day when I started work with him, it was in the, you know, raw materials area. He gave me a lecture on don't stay in the job that I'd just started in that day. He said, travel the world on someone else's money. And he said, and also much the same as your first boss said, you just keep learning. And I suppose before I started in the role, I didn't know what to expect. And then the first day I turned up and was advised, expect something better than this. And I suppose that hit hard. I didn't go home from that on the first day and think, oh, bloody hell, I just started there and he's trying to throw me out of the place. I actually went home and thought, all right, so what you're saying is true, is there's a lot more to do than just here, but learn as much as you can here and then go and do that. But if that's...
It's
that's,
great, isn't it, to be inspired by your first boss.
Oh, man, he was great. And this bloke, he was in the Aden conflict in the late 50s, early 60s, I think it was. And he was in the engineering corps. And then he went to Thailand and all sorts of places where there was always conflict and they might have been building a bridge or assisting the local communities. He ended up with, I think the military medal because he was injured while he was drunk on a train that was attacked by rebels in Thailand. So you know, here's the cart out all of these stories about whatever. And you'd ask him about the work. Oh, you know, how big was that dam or the bridge? And he'd say, oh, don't worry about any of that. We actually, you know, we took this plane up one day and parachuted out of it, et cetera. So I think that was the hook in there. And you know, this is the whole thing about travel and communication and getting involved with people is that hook that someone says to you, oh, well, you know, Bazza did these things and jumped out of a plane with a pair of knickers as a parachute. And you go, actually, I might have a crack at that.
But it makes you realize that so much more is possible, doesn't it? And I think that's one of the things that I suppose that's why I like talking to you and the other people is demonstrating there's so many other people out there that we know and we should spend more time finding more about. But that is also saying to other people, you know, go, just as you're saying, go and explore, go and do something. Because you've been to, I looked at the list, but the ones that stuck out for me, for you, you worked in Alaska.
Yep.
And Asia.
Mm.
So what was Alaska like?
It was sort of like Darwin in Australia, but instead of having crocs, there was bears. And even in the autumn, fall, whatever they want to call it, it was cold and lots of junkies on the street. And I know I'm not trying to disparage Anchorage here whatsoever, but that was my impression of it. But interesting story about the Alaskan engagement was, go back 1986. So I've just started in the new job. Boss man has just told me that, you know, go out and explore the world. So around about that first week, I wasn't quite 18, but I went to the local pub and there was a big bouncer on the door and he's looking for ID. And he says, you know, you've got ID. And a couple of my mates did. I wasn't old enough. I was still yet to turn age 18. And I gave him a bit of lip and he gave me a flogging. So, of course, I didn't get in. So I went back a few days later thinking, oh, I'll have another crack at this. This bloke might be there. And it turns out this dude was in the paratroopers, which was at a local base on the other side of where I lived. There's a Navy base there. And so he gave me another flogging because I gave him a fair bit of lip again and told him he'd never amount to anything and a few other things. So roll forward to 2016, and I get a call from a dude. It was the 4th of December, 2016. I remember the date well. And he said, oh, this is my name. I don't know you. I've never met you before, but can we catch up before Christmas? I need some stuff done to help me out with a few things. One was in Papua New Guinea and another one in Alaska. I said, yeah, not a problem at all. So went through Sydney a couple of days later, walked into the room, and it was the bouncer that belted me twice in 1986.
Wow. He said, so he had amounted to something.
He said, I know you. And then it sort of came out. But the other people that were in the room were very, very taken aback by the fact that one lady, one man, that this fellow recognized me from someone that they didn't know he'd worked as a bouncer 30 years prior.
Yeah.
But that he'd also flogged someone that has turned up to give him a hand. And I said, how good is this? I'm going to take so much cash out of you.
But it shows, doesn't it, how you never know the people that you meet will come around. And you can have a bad experience and turn it into a good one. Generally, we're not going out to get flogging and then hoping to meet people. But you've had a range of experience and places you've been, and then PhD.
Oh well, the Juris Doctor in Australia is not at the PhD. It's a doctorate, but it's not classified as the PhD, which is, I mean, that's a fancy title.
Seems a bit harsh.
Yeah. And of course, Europeans use JD as doctor if you talk to any European with that degree. But in Australia, we're a little bit less receptive to people that don't have a PhD or the D. And of course, no, you never actually quite made it, mate. But then the counter side is if you end up with a PhD in Australia, all of a sudden you're unemployable. You have to be an academic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Sure that's a generalization, and I can think of a couple of PhDs. One of my friends was he had two PhDs from South Africa, and he was a really good dude, and he wasn't stuck in academia. He was in business. He was a part owner of an airport, so he had a lot of commercial understanding, and he was a really good mentor in a business sense. And I remember what he said to me was, you can have all of the degrees you want. You can have doctorates or whatever, masters. He said, but just remember, anyone that acts like a kindly old grandfather to you is not your friend. And he explained why. He said, they're coming at you from a different angle. He said, because you will never put an old head on young shoulders. And what they're doing is, if they're purporting to be your friend along the way, in actual fact, they're milking you for something. And maybe that's not, you know, a bad thing. Maybe they're looking for, well, what's the answer to this? Or maybe they're looking for something else, as opposed to some sort of, you know, dictatorial approach where they say you can never pass go. But he was a very good mentor in that sense, because he made me realize that even in business sense, because he and I were in a little bit of business, plus I was in some other arrangements at the time, is, you know, there's that classic case about there's no friends in business, but there's also no reason for people to be unfriendly with each other in business. And that kept coming back to me all the time. So it was really good like that. And unfortunately, he passed away of leukemia in 2018. And I'm still in touch with his family. But I still think about him for some of the things that we did together and what he did and we talked about. And we worked on some disputes over the years together where I wouldn't have learned as much out of it had I not been involved in it with him.
Yeah. And it's great, isn't it, when we can look back at those people who've had an influence in our life, particularly because of the nature of our work. I think you tend to have one or two people who've been exceptional in terms of, you know, I've certainly had it way above my mental, you know, ability and the rest, but sharing knowledge and insight, and that's been incredibly helpful. And they are things that sometimes I don't think I appreciated as fully as I should. And it was only sort of later you look back and think, oh, actually, yeah, I probably was told that. And it's an interesting thing is how over a career you develop an ability to be more sort of introspective and look at how you've performed and then sort of grade that against some of the advice you've had from people. But your juris was, didn't you cover slavery?
Yes. And there's nothing modern about it, I can tell you that.
And then that was the point, because the title is, you know, modern slavery. And yet I just thought from, you know, you start from a point of view that you're an engineer, and you've done engineering and you're working, and then I'm not sure where, at what stage of your career you then do juris on modern slavery. It's quite a switch.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to, you know, the early 2000s, when I go and have a session with someone to think about how is it at this point, I'm a construction contractor, I'm a technocrat working on different projects, building roads, building runways, working on airports or, you know, buildings, blah, 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 over the horizon radar systems, everything, anything that would come up, anything that was weird, I would go for it. Whereas other people, colleagues, peers, whatever you want to call it, that I worked with, would say, no, we'll just stick in this area because we know we can make dough, or we know that is what is coming at us every day. And so learned a lot out of that. But I suppose shifting into this other zone of where I thought there's got to be more to this. You know, you can do the same thing day in, day out. What are you learning from that? Went to do a bit more study. Actually got a flogging in the study in the first stage is when I went back to it, where I wasn't getting some concepts. I erroneously was thinking everything was a transaction. Everything, you know, was, you know, you just write an essay and then all of a sudden you bang that in and someone looks at it and says, yeah, tick, you're through. And yeah, the first couple I did, that was just the big cross that came back and said, have another crack at this because you're carrying on like an idiot, in a sense. And I was, gave that a lot of thought. But back to the slavery aspect, and I actually owe this to Kid One, who's a lawyer who's was a prosecutor for a number of years, and now she's involved in environmental justice. And the case that was on for Vanuatu the other week, where the ICJ handed down, she was interviewed by the National News in Australia for that. In fact, the extension of that is Kid Number Two, who's a scientist, she's a geologist, is very heavily involved in the environmental side of things. Also had a big influence on me in relation to what I studied under the juris, because she kept saying to me, you're doing it wrong. Why do you keep wrecking the environment with the people that you work with, people work for, when you could be doing something better? And she did some fairly solid work in the background towards the UN about emptying out the FSO Safer when it was holding 1 million litres of crude that could have leaked into the Red Sea. And then of course, my wife and Kid Number Three would comment to me, you should get more into the side of understanding humans more. I wouldn't say that was my first step to go and say, all right, well, let's have a look at slavery. What it was this perception that the UN charter, you know, which amongst other things outlaws a whole heap of things like conquest. You got to ask yourself, well, what's all that about? Why isn't conquest anymore? Then I started questioning, well, if there's this Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was actually drafted by an Aussie, Dr. Herbert Evatt, and I think he might have been Secretary General of the UN at some point. Anyway, so 10th of December 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights comes out. There's a bunch of things in there, but Article 4 essentially says that all humans have the inalienable right to freedom. You can't give it up and you can't sell it. So there's a slavery prohibition straight away. And I started to think about, well, what does this actually mean? So when you look at Section 253 of the Constitution in Papua New Guinea, for example, express prohibition on slavery. That's interesting. Have a look at some of the other specific nations that I was working with at the time. Also express prohibition on slavery. So I went back to the Australian Constitution, which, you know, your family has a connection to that bill, and they left it out.
Sorry.
They left it out. So
yeah,
my questioning was, well, so what's this all about? Ultimately, the way that I drove that discussion was, apart from the inalienable right never to give up your own freedom, I did some study on that said, you know, at any one time in Australia, there might be 5,000 to 10,000 slaves, you know, with slavery being, you know, debt bonding or taking a passport, not necessarily someone in shackles, but that is potentially possible as well.
Modern,
But I then looked into this concept of, so what would it take to enshrine anti-slavery provisions into Australian law? And there was a piece of legislation at the time, which is now legislation. It was a bill that was called the Modern Slavery Bill. So I wrote a paper on that from the perspective of how is it when corporations make decisions about what they do with their cash and for their assets, do they somehow have in the forefront of their mind that they're not going to affect people's rights or adversely affect people's rights? And this is back to the Joni Mitchell, Ozzy Osbourne comparison in a sense, which is if I took the Joni Mitchell approach or respect to her, it would be that everyone has to get on with each other. If I took the Ozzy Osbourne approach, it was, as Ozzy would say, something like, well, that's bollocks. No one's probably loving each other forever. So we need to find a way through this with all the knuckling and everything that goes on. But the Australian bill didn't actually have any penalty underneath it. There was a reporting requirement, which, great.
But nothing else.
Whereas the New South Wales legislation that was supposed to come out just prior to it, and it came out sort of concurrently, I think, in the end, hefty fines. I'm talking $20 million plus, which is about £3, of course, in the UK. But the point being with that is when I wrote up a rubric that said, yeah, so give some thought to this when you're making your contracting decisions. Because what you don't want to do is just say to people, give me some sort of placating policy that says, we promise that we will do all of this stuff. In actual fact, how could you ever measure that? And so it was more about helping to remediate the supply chain and say to them, when we buy something off you at $1 a ton and there's slavery involved and corruption for that matter, I'll pick on the corruption one later if we do have time. If the slavery involved in that, it's actually costing you money more because the person that's being enslaved is getting essentially nothing. Someone else is taking the cash that would otherwise be there, have been theirs. So if you can remove that person that controls that mechanism by remediating its supply chain, coming forward and stepping forward rather than stepping back, you can actually, the person that's enslaved right now does get the opportunity to have their own income, do their own things, come back to that inalienable right to freedom. And the person of the wrongdoing is then dealt with other parts of the law. And yet we've got this rebalancing of the supply chain that says, here's a little bit more competition, if you like, as opposed to that corrupted process that means that people have lost their rights.
And I see, and it's stopping people taking that degree of advantage, isn't it, over, as you say, if you buy something for £1 a ton, which is clearly not its true value, and the impact on not just people but in environment. There's more and more work in countries that are more susceptible to that financial pressure, shall we say, whether through legitimate means, whether through government or otherwise, but they're not helped in that, in their disadvantage. I was really interested, you know, because I sort of go and do some research that you'd done, you know, Juris on Modern Slavery, because I thought it was a really different subject. It wasn't something I expected to find, you know, looking into the background. Well, because it's a big departure, isn't it? But it's also, listening to you talk, it's about your experience, isn't it? It's about taking your experience and saying, actually, I've seen things that are, you know, not good, and therefore I understand their impact. And it's brilliant that your children have had a real influence on you, because I think that's a great thing when you can actually say your children have encouraged, cajoled, pressured you to think in a different way. I think as adults we can be quite quite poor at dismissing, you know, our children's views of, oh, you're too young, you don't understand. Your children clearly are highly accomplished in their achievements, and, you know, they should be on the podcast.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing. Oh, let's have something. Let's go something lighter, you know, because you've travelled the world. What's made you stay, you know, in Australia and not relocate to Geneva or, well, perhaps not Alaska, but I've never actually been to Alaska. We planned it. Just an aside. I years and years ago, we were planning to go to Alaska, and then my wife became pregnant. But the lovely thing was, I mean, it must be, so it's, I only 28, so 29, 30 years ago. But it was the fact that you could just pick up the phone and you'd hear this funny dialing tone, and then you'd speak to somebody and they'd say, you know, I won't do the accent, but, you know, hi, and I'd say, hi, I'm, you know, I'm Bill, I'm calling from Birmingham. And they'd say, Birmingham, I'd say, England. And you'd be calling at something stupid o'clock at night or whatever it was because of you're trying to book sort of a hotel. And that's never left me, that feeling that there is this ability, isn't there, to connect and go to different countries. And you've been to them. So anyway, I sidetracked. What took you back to Australia? What made you think, actually, Australia is the place for me to stay?
And I've had opportunities put before me to do the full expat thing and relocate overseas for long periods of time. I think initially I was pursuing that in one sense, you know, whether consciously or otherwise. But at the time it became available to me, my wife and kids were at those sort of parts in their careers and their studies and their lives that it would have been terribly disruptive to them to move them again, because they had moved a few times. But as it turned out, for all of my work was, in some years I was doing more than 100 flights a year. So in one sense, it was much easier for them to be, I'm not saying sedentary in the sense of, you know, never leaving that town whatsoever, but sedentary in a sense that they had a sort of a location they could call home and be there. But with no restriction of if they wanted to come with me at all to wherever I was going to. And so, you know, my wife's been to Africa with me, India, you know, Southeast Asia, et cetera, et cetera. But I suppose that was probably the original reason for it. Now, as much as I want to move to a special place in Indonesia because of the surf, and it's super cheap there right now, but we won't put that on the podcast because I don't want anyone to know where it is, because I'll end up turning up and learning how to surf.
Yeah, they're all gone.
I think if you do the classic thing that some people do, which is they get to close to retirement or some other age, and then they shift to Italy and buy a €1 house and do it up and all the rest of it, if that's not your vogue, where you're actually heading to, what your plan is, everything else, it can be probably quite punishing for you, because you do read the stories about people that went to, I don't know, Sicily for a year and had the house and did the reno on it and then went, oh, we've got no friends. Similarly in Australia, so where my house is south of Sydney and it's on the coast and everything else, there's a lot of people that they'll get to retirement age and they'll shift to the Gold Coast in Queensland, and they have to wear sandals with their socks and all those sorts of wonderful things. But my uncle was a bank manager in Queensland back in the 70s and 80s, and he reckoned that anyone that came up from the south of the border came up with a white shirt and $5 and they didn't change either, which meant that they weren't very outgoing. You know, they'd go and sit in their new house and say, I don't know anyone, what do I do? Some would join bowls clubs or golf or whatever it is. So I think what drives us to, apart from familiarity, to stay in certain places is the fact that you've got the opportunity to leave it whenever you want, if you're so inclined.
Yeah. But you feel comfortable there, don't you? As you say, with your family, and you've always got that bit to go back to.
I've never felt comfortable anywhere, Bill. I can genuinely say to you, and people have said to me, why would you not live in a particular location? And my answer to that is I've never found a location that I actually want to spend my entire time in. I would rather go to different ones.
Keep moving.
Yeah.
Is that wanderlusty you were put in on the first date? Okay, slightly different question.
Would be.
Brisbane. Because one of the things I was really impressed with Brisbane, if people haven't been there, Brisbane is a smallish city, incredibly competitive. I've loved the fact that it's a small city and yet it has the balls. It's really going against Sydney and Melbourne. I think they've got zoning. It's a really bizarre question, isn't it? Zoning, right. And I love the fact they've built the bridge on the pods, whatever you call it, along the river. But on the south part of the river, they've moved they've got a beach there, haven't they? Sort of a public space area. And then they've got arts and crafts. I mean, have you been there recently? Do you think that's a good way of developing a city? Because that's very created, isn't it? You know, they've moved things to those areas. Do you think that's better than just allowing cities just to grow sporadically? Left field question.
Yeah. I actually think it's a great premise that they've got here. I mean, the river you've seen in Brisbane, of course, which is called the Brown Snake, it's full of sharks. It's full of all sorts of horrible other things, snakes and whatever. You're crazy if you're going to swim in it. But to put some sort of swimming arrangement, you know, forget about whatever the water quality might be on any given day with 1,000 kids or people swimming in it. But the basic premise is that, you know, that's great to have it there. And now there's a new, I think there might be 7 bridges across the river or thereabouts in that sort of short area now. There's a new casino there. Bit of an issue with that. I think they haven't gone broke, but they're certainly not as liquid as they should be. But Brisbane has grown itself into something that is attractive. And I really like Brisbane as a city to live in, and I have a place here. I'm at it now. It's very handy for me. And if I wanted to fly to Dubai, I would fly out of Brisbane rather than drive 2.5 hours from my other house to the airport near Sydney and fly from there. It's just so I can go to the airport here in 16 minutes.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because Brisbane, you know, must be regarded as Australia's sort of third, fourth city. And yet it's grown a stake in its own right, isn't it, because of the way it's developed. That's why I was really talking about it, because opportunities. And then surfing. So I saw the other day that some guy had a massive bite out of his surfboard.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Was that was, it wasn't on Bondi, it was on...
Cavarita Beach.
Yeah. So have you, what's your worst experience, you know, when you've been surfing? And then can you describe for me what it, because I can't surf. I tried once a few years ago. Obviously, it was shortly after I'd had my back operation.
Oh, no.
Really, that was why I couldn't do it. I struggled to get my fat, lardy body even onto the surfboard. And my son was saying, just kneel. What do you mean, just kneel? And they managed to stand up. All I managed to do was at the appropriate time, I'd be holding onto the surfboard as a wave crushed me deep into the sand below, making me think, I'm not going to drown. I'm going to die from eating three huge mouthfuls of sand. So what's your worst experience then?
I reckon this is the genuine worst experience I've ever had. I think it was about 40. And I started surfing or being on a board when I was about 6 or 7, say. Surfed all the way through my teens, had a few years away from it because I'd travelled and all the rest of it, but generally got back into it, and that was cool. And I'd caught a wave from a long way out, surfed it all the way to the beach, and then I'd pulled off in the shore break, which is where it goes onto the shore, of course, and let's say I'd surfed it for 100 metres, well. And there's a kid there that's about 8 years old, and I grabbed my board and I sort of stood there and he said, oh, how long you been learning? And I thank you.
Oh, ripped.
That is the worst surf experience I've ever had in my life. I can think of all the floggings that I've had getting dragged across a reef or the sand or whatever. And that is the worst. That's the one that I think of.
Truly burned. So what's it like when you have a brilliant experience coming out of the barrel then?
Yeah, I mean, you've got generally got two types of surfers. Ones that go for the barrel and hunt for that cylinder to get through, which is, that's really difficult surfing. And then you've got this other one where you get in front of the barrel, but you're out on the wall and you do all sorts of maneuvers off there. For the elderly folk like me, it's probably better to go out onto the wall and avoid getting stuck in behind, because you've got to work it in a particular way. And
yeah,
when your back starts playing up, or your knee or your hip or something like that, then you need to be super flexible and very focused on it. So most recently, the barrels that I've had were in Indonesia earlier this year, because it's one of those places where there's plenty of barrels available, or the weirdo wave pool in Sydney where you can go to and as a manufactured barrel.
So apart from potentially heading to some secret location in, I'm not even going to name the country again, just in case people start looking in a mm-hmm. different mm-hmm. place. What's your next biggest plan or plans over the next couple of years, do you reckon?
Well, surf has got to be at the foremost of it, because, getting older, I'm going to miss out on more surf later on, if you like. And I was only having a chat with someone yesterday. There was a conference in town for the Australia Pacific Business, blah, blah. And this fellow was saying, he's in his mid-60s and he wants to go on a lot of holidays, because one of his work colleagues just retired at 65 and found out that he had cancer, and now he's only got several months to live, but he'd sort of, held off on his whole life to get to that. So I'm sort of taking the other approach, where surf as much as you can, work as much as you can, and if you can get a bit of a holiday in there as well, holiday as much as you can, and try and measure those things up. There was a bloke I ran into in the early 90s, and only a couple of times, and he told me he was doing a philosophy course. What's all that about? And he said, well, you only do things in life for three reasons. It's fame, fortune, friendship. And he said, and you measure how much, you might 1% of fortune or X, Y, Z of the other two. And he said, and then you work from there, work backwards how you're going to fit that into your life. And so I sort of follow that model, which is, if you can spend a lot of time in the water, do it. And am I guilty of turning on Teams meetings and going out for a surf and billing the client and then coming back in and picking up on the Teams meeting like I've been the whole time? Absolutely.
Don't say it.
Absolutely, I've done it. And I intend on doing it tomorrow. But no, so if you...
Well, they won't hear this for weeks. So it's good. So more surfing. Clearly, you'll spend time with your daughters and your wife. When are you next going to be in the good old UK?
Maybe next year. I need to come and see, my good friend Bill.
Well, it'd be good if you good if you get over. Okay, you talked about Joni Mitchell and Ozzy Osbourne. So, whose album did you buy first, a Joni Mitchell or an Ozzy Osbourne?
Ozzy Osbourne, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath.
You see, I bought Joni Mitchell, and it's only in recent times, and then I've read a lot of the Ozzy Osbourne obituaries. I genuinely hadn't realised how influential he had been, and I think it was because of the distraction of the Ozzy Osbourne persona image. And then when he did the reality show, I can remember watching bits of that, but not all of it. And so I didn't realise, just as I say, how influential he'd been. And all these people talking in his obits about the impact on their life in music. These were all musicians. It was really incredibly impressive. I don't own an Ozzy Osbourne or a Black Sabbath LP. Sorry, people out there, what can I say? I mean, I daren't tell people some of the stuff I listen to now, because it would just be, it's right out there now. My family are deeply embarrassed sometimes if they get in the car and someone's with them. And,
No, it's okay. There's no need to feel shame, Bill.
I didn't say I'm ashamed.
You should be then.
I didn't say I'm ashamed. I just said they think I should be ashamed, And I just like to say, put it right out there, there is nothing wrong with Miley Cyrus and Dua Lipa. I mean, I'm just putting it right out there. They are top singers. So perhaps not Ozzy Osbourne, but, you know, up there. But Whitey, we're going to draw it to close. I've loved speaking to you. You're looking great. I hope you get out and do some surfing. Obviously, it's bedtime for you now because it's quite late. Quite late for you.
9 p.m.
Go and get a bit of shut eye. And do let us know if you're going to be over.
Yep, for sure.
Thanks very much. I'll see you in person soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.